1 Kings chapter 19. It reads, Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, so may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow. Then he, speaking of Elijah, he was afraid. He got up and fled for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. He left his servant. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom tree. He asked that he might die. It is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than any of my ancestors. Lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. Suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, get up and eat. He looked, and there at his head was a cake baked of hot stones and a jar of water. He ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came a second time, touched him and said, get up and eat. Otherwise the journey will be too much for you. He got up and ate and drank. Then he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. At that place he came to a cave and spent there. Then the word of the Lord came to him saying, what are you doing here, Elijah? He answered, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away. For the past couple of weeks, we have been taking a journey to discuss what we are calling the intersection of mental health and our faith. I appreciate the high receiving to these sermons. It affirms to me that this is a topic and theme that resonates with us all, and we are all taking seriously our mental health and our mental illnesses and depression and OCD and all the things that ails us that are the product of the mind. This morning, I want to dig a little deeper with the help of someone who God is using in so many ways, including in the area of mental wellness. In just a moment, I'm going to have a discussion with Sean Ridge, Dr. Sean Ridge, an elder in the church, a professor at Johnson University in Knoxville, Tennessee. Now, as a launching pad for our discussion, I just wanted us to consider a piece of the story from what I just read from 1 Kings. Now, we don't have a lot of time to unpack this narrative. It's a rich narrative, one of the greatest prophets in the history of Israel, a guy by the name of Elijah. What you should know in terms of the context of what I just read is that Elijah just came off of a great victory. He was pitted up against the prophets of Baal, and he set up this competition, and he won the competition. God won the competition, and the loser of this competition, you get death. And so Elijah killed all the prophets, and it would seem that he was on a high. He was on the mountaintop. You know, he was victorious. God was victorious, and so it's now time for celebration, except that there was this evil king, Ahab, and his wife Jezebel, and it seemed like Jezebel ran the shots, and she ordered that Elijah, she put a bounty out on his head. And so Elijah, instead of celebrating the victory, he starts to run. And he was wiped out. And he was down. Spiritually, physically, and mentally. He was depressed. In fact, it came to a point where he said, God, just take my life. I'm better off dead. And so from this reading, I wanted us to see a couple of things in terms of the area of mental health and mental wellness. You know, oftentimes we get to our lowest moments after coming off a high moment. You ever, at like one turn, you're like, yay! And then that next moment, you're like, ooh. It's not unlike the human condition for us to be way up here one moment and down one moment. But what I want us to see, at least in this text, is that even in Elijah's down moment, God met him there. That's what I want us to see in the reading of that text. The angel of the Lord came to Elijah and spoke to Elijah and touched Elijah and said, hey man, get up. Get something to eat. This is what we've been talking about when it comes to our mental wellness, our spiritual wellness, that we need to go to God. That's the place to go. That's why the Psalms become such important pieces of literature and work and scripture, because we see the psalmists who are aching mentally and spiritually, and they go to the Lord, and the Lord meets them there. That's the desire, and God has a desire to meet us in our low points. Remember the text we read last week from Matthew, chapter 11, from the Message? Is that text in the script there? Matthew chapter 11. Are you tired, worn out, burned out on religion? Come to me, get away with me, and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me, work with me, watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. That's God's invitation for us all. God meets us in our low points, and God desires to meet us and give us what we need in those moments. I find it interesting in this text that one of the first things that the angel says to Elijah is, get something to eat. Comfort food. That's why we make comfort food, right? A warm bowl of macaroni and cheese, garlic mashed potatoes, beef stew, comfort food. Amen. Yeah, biggest amen I've got during the whole series. Comfort food. Other thing that I want us to see in this text, and it comes a little bit later on, because when Elijah responds to God, he says, God, Israel has forsaken your covenant, and I'm all by myself. One of the greatest lies that we buy into when it comes to mental health is that we're the only ones going through it. It's just me. It's only me. I'm by myself. And that's where we start to get feelings of just being so overwhelmed that the best remedy, death. You read down to 1 Kings chapter 19, verse number 14. This is what Elijah says. I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking to take my life, to take it away. And then what does God say to that? I need you to go. I need you to go do some work. I need you to go anoint another king for Syria. I need you to anoint another king for Israel. And when you get to the city, this is what you will find. There's 7,000 people who have not bowed down to the other gods. There's 7,000 people who are still faithful to me. There are 7,000 others. In other words, Elijah, you are not alone. You are not alone. Church, we need to hear that today, that we are not alone. God could have additionally said this: you're not alone, and there is help. So again, one of the greatest lies that we buy into, and I think this is sent by the evil one, it's that you are all by yourself in your struggle, and there is no one to help. Here's one of those stigmas that we have to break and get away from when it comes to mental illness. We are not alone. And there is help. That's what I want us to focus on for the remainder of our time together. I'm going to invite my friend, Dr. Sean Ridge. He's a man of God. He's a man who has dedicated his life to mental wellness, marriage and family therapy, counseling. He now teaches other students to go into this very important field. And so we're going to have a conversation about that in just a second. I scraped this intro video of Sean from his profile. Looks a little different. Must have been made a couple years ago. But let's take a look as an introduction, and I'll invite you to the stage.
Hi, I'm Sean Ridge, and I came to Johnson University in 2007, and I teach in the social and behavioral sciences. My master's and my doctoral degrees are in marriage and family therapy, and so I thoroughly enjoy talking with students about the relationships that have shaped and formed them. And so a lot of the classes that I teach are very much interested in how we engage the world around us, find God in that world, but then also how we get to be the hands and feet of Christ in the various relationships that we have. A core set of classes that is going to help equip you to understand relationships, understand individuality and how people tick and what's going on inside of them and what normal and quote-unquote abnormal look like. Or you could choose more a focus on family studies, focus more on those relational dynamics and the patterns that exist and how those shape and form the individual. I really enjoy fixing up things. I actually enjoy kind of tinkering around. Currently, right now, the project is a motorcycle that was my father's. It's about 30 years old and not running, but hopefully it will be soon. Learning more about yourself and your relationships really does equip you. You can make a difference in the lives of individuals and families.
Handsome.
Look a little different now, yeah.
Well, welcome, Sean, a good friend. So again, by way of introduction in terms of our connection and Sean's connection to this church, back in 2005, 6, I met Sean at a preacher's meeting. He was giving a presentation. And then we just quickly became good friends. I really liked his vibe. And Sean shared this idea that a lot of small in our area don't have the benefit of having a full-time counseling minister on staff. And so what he suggested and encouraged was for a group of churches to come together actively, basically pay Sean on retainer, and he would serve as a counseling minister for several of our churches. And he did that for several years. And then when he moved, Dr. Joyce Estes took that over, and that ended a few years ago. And for a while, Sean, his wife Beth, they, I think at the time, only had two kids, I think Ethan and Karis. Then they eventually had Levi and then Ezekiel. Karis, their daughter, has the distinction of showing us that she was potty trained when we first had them over for dinner. She came to our house in the middle of our living room and took off her diaper and peed on our living room floor. Potty trained. She didn't need a diaper. That's really impressive.
I'm going to have dinner with her. She's now a senior in college and down at Georgetown, just north of Lexington. I'm going to have dinner tonight. And I'm going to mention that we talked about her this morning. She'll enjoy that. Yeah.
And she will tell you, if you were with me, she's sure that I told that story, because I tell that story all the time. So, married, Beth, four kids. In your own words, how did you come to work in the mental health field? And how has your faith influenced your career?
When I started college, I started at Ohio State and did a couple years there, and then I transferred up to Bluffton College, university now. Actually, soon to be a branch of Findlay University. Bluffton's kind of being consumed that way. But when I was at Bluffton, I majored in psychology in youth ministry because I started thinking I was going to do the pre-med thing because I've always wanted to be a people helper, but realized I don't care enough to get through med school. Everybody was like, half the people that apply don't get in, half the people that get in don't finish. And I was like, well, that sounds kind of hard. Why don't I just do the psychology thing? And did that in youth ministry, and I worked in youth ministry for a little bit. But what I found was that it was very obvious to me very quickly that what I want to do is be on very much on that front line of pain and suffering, hurting people. I wanted to have very concrete skills to try to help people who are hurting, and that's when I chose therapy. I'm family oriented, and I had no idea that social work and psychology and counseling, family therapy, those are all different mental health disciplines. I just thought marriage and family sounded like the kind of thing I would want to do. So I kind of picked it. And at that point, Beth and I had met and married, and we did the, hey, I need to do grad school. Where do you want to do it? And it was basically anywhere but Ohio. And so we went to Abilene. We just moved to Abilene, Texas, and did that. And I was there for about 10 years. And while I was there, worked, counseled, got my licensure, did the therapy thing, and then realized that I like doing it, but I also would love to teach others how to do it. So I started my doctoral work. A family brought us back here. We had a grandmother in hospice, and so we moved back so that Beth could take care of her grandmother, and that's when I was starting to piece together various counseling jobs. Was at a group practice in town here, but then my passion has always been church stuff. I want to be a resource for ministers. I want to be a resource for the faith community at that intersection of mental health, relational health, and just well-being, and then just as we live out our faith. So, was here for several years, and then an opportunity came to teach full-time, and that's kind of what took me to Knoxville, and been there since.
And so you're teaching, but you're still in practice?
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
And how many years collectively would you say you've, including schooling, would you say you've given to the field of?
I've been practicing therapy since 97.
Okay.
I don't let my beard grow that long because it's really white. So now I just shave it so you don't know how old I am. I'm younger this way.
Now, with all the years that you've put into to mental health, all the things that's been going on in our world, I can imagine that you have stories galore that we could be here for the next several weeks unpacking those. But in general, what are some of the challenges that you've seen and faced in your work, in your career?
Yeah, I think the way I would say it, for me as a helper, probably one of the biggest challenges I've faced was what is my role in this? The helping professions is more of a behavioral health. It's a medical profession. Where is the appropriate integration of spirituality and faith and religiosity? And I think what I found is that any good counselor is going to honor and respect your faith commitments. They're going to work within your worldview. They're not out to challenge. And certainly what therapy is not being smarter than everybody and telling them what to do. Because if you go into the field thinking that's what you're going to do, you will burn out. Because the people come in and they're doing everything I would have known to do. And so it's more about walking alongside and helping and having a skill set, absolutely. But my job isn't to just tell people what to do. It's to walk with them and help refine. And I have ideas about what healthy looks like and how people get stuck and what mental health disorders and what relational patterns look like when they get dysfunctional and unhealthy. But knowing that role, but then figuring out, so when do I step in and integrate faith and spirituality and religiosity? And I guess knowing my role, I'm not your pastor. I'm not going to tell you what to believe. I will honor your beliefs, and I will challenge them if your beliefs are part of what's keeping you stuck. But I'm not challenging in the way I'm trying to undermine. It's more of, okay, so you say you believe this, but you're having a hard time living it out. And so in some of those ways, we blur lines.
Mm-hmm.
But my role is pretty specific. It's a healthcare professional. It's a provider. And that's where I guess one of the stigmas is that I think in faith communities, you have to find a Christian counselor. And I think you just have to find a good counselor. There are Christian counselors that are not very good therapists, in my opinion. And there are people who don't advertise as Christian counselors who are really good therapists, and they can help. And so it's more about the skill of the provider, maybe, than the name or the tag or the marketing they're using.
Yeah, that, I'm glad you mentioned that. I know at the beginning of this series, I shared that I am not a professional counselor. If you come to me to ask for help, talk to me, I'm going to skew on the, so I'm going to inform you. I'm going to go straight to the religiosity. I'm going to go straight to the, and I'll try my best with some of the training that I have, but I'm not a professional. But one of the things I hear you said, I just want to make this clear, is that when someone says they're a Christian counselor, that doesn't automatically mean it's good. And if someone says, I'm not a Christian counselor, that doesn't mean that that's bad. So there's good counseling and there's bad counseling.
Exactly. Yeah. And the reality is, again, in the professional world, what is pastoral care, pastoral therapy, biblical counseling, Christian counseling, professional counseling, those are all slightly different. To the average person, they can all sound very, very similar. There is different training that goes into all of those different areas. And there are people that are practicing in every one of those areas, doing amazing work, wonderful ministry. And there are others in those fields that have the credentials but aren't very good at it. So it's much more about, if you're looking for a counselor, find a good fit. Find one that you trust. Find one that you ask enough questions to feel confident this person can walk with you through it. And if they come off telling you what to do, that immediately ought to be a red flag that, okay, this isn't what counseling really is. It's not about just telling you what to do, and then if you do it, you win kind of thing. It's the counseling's more complicated than that.
How have you seen, so the title of this series is, you know, Breaking the Stigmas, Mental Health and Faith. And so we're trying to talk about the intersection of mental health and faith. So again, you're a man of God, you're a Christian, you know, here that early on that you had a desire to even go into youth ministry. How have you seen the intersection of mental health, mental wellness, and faith?
Yeah, I think one of the metaphors I've used is that I've wanted to always have a one foot in the more faith community and religious world and another foot in the professional world, and whichever audience I'm talking to, I'm advocating for the other one. So if in my professional world, I'm trying to say that maybe spirituality and religion's more than just a cognitive coping skill, that there's more to it than that. And when I'm in my faith communities, I'm saying maybe there's something to mental health in that. And I think one of the challenges I have is that sometimes people view a mental health difficulty or a relational difficulty as a lack of faith. And so sometimes in our faith communities, we reinforce that by thinking, well, if you're anxious, let's pull out Matthew and read about not worrying about the birds of the air or the flowers in the field. And if someone's got an anxiety disorder, if someone is genuinely anxious and it's created that overwhelming sense, reading that passage doesn't magically make that anxiety go away. It can be helpful in reinforcing that we serve a God and we can walk with a God who will walk with us through those kinds of things, but it's not an easy fix. And so you can't just throw a Bible verse at it and address the trauma that people go through and the difficulties they face and the exhaustion. You know, talked about Elijah and just the exhaustion that you feel when you see no hope. And sometimes I think that's been one of the challenges is, as a therapist, when can I help instill that hope, but know my lane? I'm not your pastor. I'm not here to tell you what to believe. But that's where I think it's an amazing opportunity when ministers and healthcare professionals can work side by side and help one another and benefit one another and build on what each other provides.
Yeah. I appreciate that. If someone used a metaphor once that, you know, someone's drowning, you don't yell at them, you need to learn how to swim. Like that, that's
yep.
Probably not
that's
helpful.
That's real helpful. Thank you. Yeah. And yep, very much so.
So I don't know. I haven't talked to you offline about this, but I'm really wondering what the next 10 years is going to look like in terms of our mental health as a direct result of the 2020 pandemic. But I would imagine in recent years, there are a set of mental health struggles and challenges that are more prevalent than others. Could you share, just in our general time, in your practice, what are you seeing as the most seen issues of mental health?
Yeah. In kind of a broad sense, what I would say is that most mental health is about anxiety and depression, because that's how that's when you start to realize how overwhelmed, distressed, distraught you are. That anxiety, depression can come from trauma, from life circumstances, from biological imbalances. There's a lot of different ways, places it can come from. And then when we have those experiences, we often get stuck in patterns of trying to cope and manage that. Unhealthy relationships, addictions, all sorts of things. More recently, what I'm seeing, and I think the field is seeing, is anxiety disorders are going up. People have less margin, there's less resiliency, and it's hard, and we're getting overwhelmed quicker. And all the people that seem to know have a theory about why that is. You can blame culture, you can blame, kids these days are just not developing what they need to. I think any of those simplistic answers is not helpful. If you're actually living with people and walking with them, it's realizing that, what we need to know that we're not alone. And you heard that over and over in the Ezekiel passage. It's just, or Elijah passage. It's important to remember that we're not doing this alone, and that it is hard. My running favorite definition of sin is the failure to be human. I think at times we think we should be more than we really can be. We should be strong enough to handle everything by ourselves, and then when we can't, we feel like we're failing and we're sinning. Maybe you were created to not handle everything by yourself. Maybe being human is the very thing you were created to be, and sin enters in when you expect something other than that. And if you can frame it that way, suddenly my disorders are, I'm made to be in community with people in this room. I'm made to do this life with people, not by myself and alone and, picture perfect. I think sometimes, unfortunately, churches are the last place you want to admit your stuff, because it gets overlapped with, now you're not as faithful, or it's a result of sin. And maybe it was a result of a bad choice or a bad habit or other stuff in your life, but this ought to be the place we can talk about it. And sometimes we actually create a double bind where this is the last place you'd want to actually admit some of your baggage.
It's a quick follow-up, and I appreciate you saying, trying to find a direct link to what's fueling and informing our anxiety is difficult. However, let me ask your opinion. What role do you think social media is playing the high anxiety there?
I would probably boil it down to two things. And again, that's overly simplistic. It's complex. But one is, I think that instant gratification, if you want it, you can look for it, you find it quickly. So it does, I think, deteriorate our capacity to want, but not get instantly. And so then when other parts of our life, when we want something and it doesn't happen easily and quickly, we feel like something's wrong. And we maybe lose the capacity to follow through, to put in the hard work, that type of thing. So that instant gratification is part of it. I also think it's making it less interpersonal. I'm not on the bandwagon of, wow, technology is pulling everybody away from all other human relationships. You're still interacting with a lot of human relationships. I mean, my kid plays video games, and he'll have four friends, but they're all on comms together playing while they're playing video games. When I played a video game growing up, I had to sit in front of the Atari by myself and had hope. And so he is interacting in ways that I never got to interact with. So I do think there is some good about all the technology, but it does diminish the capacity to sit and make eye contact and one-on-one really be vulnerable. I do think we're losing that with all of the social media. And I'll critique the adults just as fast as I will the kids these days. My wife and I realize we're on the phone way too much when our kids are around. But we're as guilty as they are of not putting it down.
Atari, young folks, was a video game system that we used to.
One button, one joystick. I could manage that. There's too many buttons on these anymore. I don't know.
Just want to keep everyone engaged. So one of the other words that we've been using throughout this series is the word stigma. There are so many mental health stigmas. So how would you describe mental health stigmas, and why do you think it's such a difficult barrier to overcome, particularly when it comes to the church?
Yeah, I think the stigma comes because I think we've bought into, and this is where I go a little more culture. I think we've bought into a broad general myth that if you do, and within Christian communities, if you do life the way God wants you to do life, you will be spared from all the bad stuff. And at a popular level, they talk about that as a health and wealth gospel kind of thing, that if you live according to Christian values, then you won't have all those bad things happening in your life. If you do this well, your marriage will survive and you'll never experience divorce, right up until you do. And it's so I think we've bought into this idea that if we do it right, God is going to have to bless us with the good stuff. And when that, and for me as a therapist, that's been one of the challenges. One of the harder things I've found is, that formula just doesn't work. The clients I see are doing everything, as far as I can tell, as faithfully as they can, and they're still suffering. They're still hurting. In that video, I mentioned about being the hands and feet of Christ, and for most of my career, that was one of those metaphors I used. That's why I like being on the front lines of doing everything I do. But I've realized over the last 5 to 10 years. More often, I'm more of a witness and an advocate that God is already present in all of this, and I'm just helping you see it. I'm not bringing Jesus as the counselor. I'm not always the hands and feet of Christ. Christ is present and active, and sometimes I just get to witness and call attention. Similar to what you're saying, that God is in that suffering. But that's very counter to this idea that if I do it right, I won't suffer. I won't hurt. If I live a faithful life, then these bad things won't happen. And so then I think that's where the stigma, especially in the church, comes in, is not only are you not strong enough and not good enough, but your faith isn't strong enough or good enough either. And now it's suddenly your inability to work through the depression and your need to take a pill is a sign that you're just not, you just don't have enough joy in your life. And if you were more faithful and lived more gratitude, then that would just magically make the depression go away. And it just doesn't work that way. And so,
look, we're in a space where we're trying to journey towards getting real with each other and sharing our struggles, confessing that first sermon was, I'm not okay. And so we get to a place where we begin to admit that I'm not okay. I'm not okay. So as loving church-going people, we want to support. We want to help. So when someone comes to us and says, I'm not okay, we're now kind of faced with like, hey, now what do we do? From a Christian perspective, what do you believe is the role of the church in supporting those that have mental health challenges?
Yeah, what I would do is I would probably broaden it just a little bit. It's more than just for mental health challenges. It's about doing life together. I think the role of the church is to be the body of Christ in one another's lives as we do life, whatever that is. That includes mental, behavioral, physical health problems, but it includes all of those things. It includes everything, not just the hard times. If you're able to be that for one another, it requires, there was a, again, I'm going to date myself here. There was a Christian artist back in the 80s, 90s named Michael Card. And he wrote a song called The Basin and the Towel. And talking about foot washing as a sacred moment, a place where God is present and divinely there in a way that other day-to-day life is harder to see. And one of the lines in the song says, for the basin and the towel, for this to work, for that sacred moment to work, it takes one willing to kneel and one willing to yield. And for me personally, when I heard that song and just actually kind of listened to that, I realized I do the kneeling thing really well. If there's a church work day, I'm scrubbing the toilets. I'll do whatever. I'll go do the service thing really well. The yield part, I am really uncomfortable. Because that means I need help. That means I have to ask. I have to let someone in. And I would much rather look like I got myself together and help someone else than be the one who needs someone to help them. But that means I'm an obstacle to the basin and the towel working. If I can't yield, then I'm robbing my friends from the opportunity to actually help and to be there. And again, that goes back to that failure to be human. What if I was actually created to need other people and to be more vulnerable, to yield when life is too much? And that's, so I think that's the role of the church, is to do life together, but you have to be willing to kneel and yield. Probably yielding is harder, because we tend to serve pretty well, but we don't let people in. We don't want you to know what I really think, what's really going on, where I'm really hurting. We ask how you doing, and they say, yeah, I'm good. Are you? All the time? Really? So yielding and kneeling and just doing life together, I think that's probably the way I'd say it.
What if we were created to need people? Write that down, everybody. So in our effort to be helpful, we are often guilty of foot-in-mouth syndrome. We say things, I think, well-intentioned, well-meaning, but what are some things we need to avoid saying or doing when trying to support someone in mental health?
I think what I would say is the broad answer, which is a little more generic, is to be, what I would encourage you to avoid is simple answers. They can come in any given form. One of those answers would be, wow, you need a therapist. Okay, a therapist can't fix anything either. The therapist is not all-powerful. So brainstorm ideas, help them, but it's less about you providing an answer to fix it, to make it go away, so that we can do life at a surface level again. And it's more about sitting with them in the hurt. Be present with them. Avoid trying to grasp fully what God is doing in their life. I think some of the most harmful things around grief and loss is that, well, God has a plan, or that God's got them in heaven now. And we use language like that, that maybe cognitively is, we believe, but in that moment, at a gut level, that's not very helpful. What I need is someone to actually sit and hold my hand while I cry and just be present and to just be with. I do believe through it in heaven. But right now, that could shortchange, and it kind of hijacks the experience of just being with and hurting and lamenting together. I think that we as a church largely have lost any kind of tradition of lament, of acknowledging pain and suffering without feeling like we should be able to fix it quickly. And just genuinely sitting with and doing life with, being present, being curious in one another. When you see someone and you ask them how they're doing, they just say, fine, but you know there's hardship. Don't single them out in the middle of the aisle at Kroger and say, no, tell me what you really think, you know, how it's really going. But find a time, grab a coffee with them, you know. Offer to watch their kids so they can go to Kroger and not have to manage all the kids. Some of the hardship in that comes for the people who are experiencing it, but it equally comes for the people who are caregiving and the ones that are doing life with those who are having difficulties. I think there's an amazing opportunity for us to be the body of Christ and walk with one another in those ways that we have to slow down and genuinely ask. And again, I think the yielding is harder than the asking. And so when you ask and they do open up, don't react too quickly with, oh, I got to fix this, I've got to solve it. Honor that they opened up to you. Thank them for being willing to share, even if you don't, and be honest, I don't have any idea what to say, but you're not alone. I'm here, and I have no idea. Let's go talk to Dion. Yeah, but
I have probably three more cards of questions we can't get to. And so Sean has been willing, or he's agreed to stay after, so we'll sing. We'll do a traditional invitation here in just a second. We'll have the benediction. And right after that, he's willing to stay here to take some Q&A from the audience. And so at the end, just want to stay for that. Just make your way to the front, and we'll try to get that started as soon as possible so we can maximize time. He does have dinner plans with his daughter, Georgetown, Kentucky. And so he'll be going there. I think you kind of answered one of the questions I got from a member was like, what do you do when you're in a position where you can't help somebody? Like you've been successful in helping others, but man, you're like, what do you do? I think you kind of answered that. Like sometimes you just gotta be present.
And that's, yeah, I think human presence, which again might go back to the social media question, that physical presence and being with is an art, and it's a ministry in itself, especially when you have enough awareness to not fill it with words trying to solve and fix. So I think it's never wrong to sit and be with someone without speaking, without providing an answer. I think if anything, it's when they share with you and you don't have a simple answer, but you're willing to sit with them, that in itself is encouraging and saying, all right, I'm not going crazy. This is hard. And there's not a quick answer, a simple answer. So yeah, the sitting with, but I also think just looking for the resources. And frankly, the resources are in this room around you. They don't all, anytime there's an issue, you don't have to go to the staff necessarily, because who are the people in this room that you really trust? You can't possibly be everybody's best friend in this room. It's impossible. But there's probably a handful of people in the room, I hope, that you do lean into and you can trust. And so lean into those people. And if they don't have good ideas and brainstorm, that there is a time to ask for helping professional help or staff help or look for other resources. So I think it's the being present and yeah. And if you really don't know what to say, then I think that should tell you don't say much, but don't walk away. Be present.
Church, was this helpful? I hope. You got just a smidgen or a tidbit of something that is helpful in allowing us to break some of the stigmas and get us out of the fear and the anxiety of, you know, I'm not okay, going to God, seeking shalom, then asking for help from one another and maybe from a professional therapist. For the final moments here, I just want to leave the stage and offer Sean an opportunity to close us out with some thoughts and to provide an invitation for prayer. If this has been our space for the past several weeks, we want to make this space a place of a prayer if we are struggling. So Sean, if you would just close us out and get ready.
I guess in closing, if there's anything I would want to share, it would be, I mean, it's right in line with the passage with Elijah, what Dion's been saying, what you've heard the last couple of weeks. I mean, if you're in here and you're hurting, I hope you heard a couple of things. One is that you're not alone. I think one of the challenges to, when we struggle, we feel like nobody knows how this feels, or if you knew this about me, you would reject me. And we self-talk in a way that actually pulls us away from the resources that are the most helpful. And so that would be one thing. I hope you've heard you're not alone. I hope you've heard being human isn't sin. What you're going through, if you've gone through hardships, trauma, your difficult relationships, marriage is hard. Parenting is hard. Learn more about my faith and everything else, you know, doing the parenting thing I do. This is hard. You're not supposed to have it all figured out and be perfect. And so I think that being, if that can free you up to realize that this is actually what it is to be human, and I'm supposed to do this with people, that it's not sin that I'm having a hard time, that I'm struggling. And then I hope a third piece, and this is the kind of on the professional side, is you heard that helping professionals like counselors are here to be a resource. We're not going to fix it all. We can't cure it all. You can't go to your doctor, get the pill, and poof, nothing. It's all gone. But at times, medication can be appropriate to help relieve some of the stressors that can then equip you with more energy to do everything else you need to do. And then there's a time when maybe you get off the meds because you don't need them anymore because you've done other things. But there's so many ways behavioral health, medical health, healthcare professionals can be a help. And any good healthcare professional is going to honor your faith. They're going to honor your religious worldviews. They're not going to undermine it. If they start challenging and undermining it, then they're not doing their profession well, because ethically that's not what we do. So if you're hurting, I hope you hear that. You're not alone. It's not sin to be human. And there is help even outside this community. But if you're in here and you're doing pretty well right now, I hope you heard a couple things too. One is that you're not alone. There are people among us here in the body of Christ and outside these walls that love you, care about you, and really are glad you're doing well. And second thing would be is that those people that care about you might not be doing as well as you are. So ask, be curious. Again, slow down and pause and in a setting that's appropriate. Don't accept good, I'm doing good, as an answer. Say, no, really. The last 2 days, what's been the hardest thing for you? Ask a little more specific question. Be curious about one another so that we can start doing life together. Maybe that'll go into hard things like depression, anxiety, other stressors. But maybe they just had an incredibly good day yesterday and nobody's asked them about it yet. And so you get to celebrate with one another. I think it's just the doing of life together. Ultimately, I just hope we can all recognize that this is a time and a place where we can do life together, we can be together, we cannot be alone, and we can kneel and yield to one another and for one another. So with that, I believe the elders will be coming up, and there's a song. So if they can pray for you, if anybody can pray for you, this is more kind of a structured way of doing that. And this could be a good start if you're interested in that. So I will step out of the way and let them sing.